We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to the second hour of Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you with us. The producers for our show, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Henry Frain, is at the controls. It's been 21 years since the oil tanker Exxon Valdez ran aground in Prince William Sound, Alaska, spilling about 11 million gallons of oil. It was one of the worst environmental disasters in history. Right now, in the Gulf of Mexico, we are watching what might be the worst environmental disaster, well, maybe in the history of the United States, an oil spill there that now puts out as much oil every 1 to 2 weeks as was spilled by the Exxon Valdez. In this hour of Focus, we'll try to talk a little bit about that event, what perhaps we can learn from it, and then to try to go to some larger questions about whether indeed people can change their attitudes, the way they live, and how they think about their relationship with nature. And our guest for the program is Charles Wolfert. He's a journalist, lifelong resident of Alaska. He's written a number of books about his home state, and also he's written about nature, history, politics, travel in the North. He's the author of a newly published book that's titled The Fate of Nature, the subtitle Rediscovering Our Ability to Rescue the Earth. It is just recently out. It's published by Thomas Dunn Books. It's a division of St. Martin's Press. If you'd like to read the book, you go out and find it in the bookstore. Our guest has been a journalist for a while now, and in fact, he worked as a reporter for the Anchorage Daily News, where he was the lead reporter for their coverage of the Exxon Valdez oil spill. He's also written for New Republic, Outside, and Discover magazines, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We also have an email. So if you'd like to send your message along that way, send your questions or comments that way, that's certainly welcome. Just send it to will-talk@illinois.edu. Either way, comments, questions, participation in the conversation is welcome. We just ask people to be brief so we can keep moving. But anybody is certainly welcome to give us a call. And Mr. Wolfert, hello.
Yes.
And as I just said, I know that this is a book that you'd been working on for a long time, and it just happened to come out right at the time of the oil spill. So I'm sure it was natural for you when people talk to you and when you talk make comments on not only what happened and what you saw 21 years ago, but what's happening right now in the Gulf.
You know, it came as a just as a weird and very unpleasant unfolding as this thing came about for me and for many other people who are involved in the Exxon Valdez oil spill. And you start to realize the kind of stress that you have built up over the years and people just have these incredibly strong emotions when it's brought to the surface, as if you've been through some kind of a war experience or something. And to see the same thing, you know, coming about again in so much the same way is just very, very disturbing.
What was it like for you to be tossed into that story back there in 1989?
Well, it was, I was young. I think I was 26 years old or 25, and it was Easter weekend. The oil spill happened on Good Friday in 1989, and I was kind of a cub reporter working in a suburban bureau. But it happened that I had a four-wheel drive vehicle that I could get to Valdez, so I was dispatched out there to Valdez and managed to get on a helicopter when there was nothing flying on the day that the oil hit shore, and was out there and saw this horrendous deep, thick oil, you know, knee-deep coming onto shore, and you could reach down into it and find beautiful seabirds like cormorants that were just completely buried and soaked in it, and came back and filed my story, and from that I began writing pretty much every day about what was happening out in the field, you know, rather than writing up the press conferences and the reports of how much equipment or what officials were there, just getting out there and observing what was happening. And it turned out to be really the most compelling way of telling the story. And so they kept me out there basically through that entire year. The newspaper bought a boat, and I just drove around in Prince William Sound and watched the oil spill and the extraordinary kind of story that of futility that developed there.
Yeah, I'm sure for everyone this was a life-changing experience, but for you as a young journalist, would you say that this was a life-changing experience?
In many different dimensions. You know, one, obviously, career-wise, it was sort of the beginning of launching my career as an author because, you know, fairly rapidly the national media left, and I was kind of there alone with the story and was writing for major publications while I still wrote for the Anchorage Daily News. But then for just personally, it really made me into an environmentalist and into a person who, I developed a really strong sense of humility in front of the nature and the fact that with technology really is not able to fix nature. I mean, we have this sense of omnipotence with our technology, but when it really comes down to it and you're standing on the beach and seeing the oil wash up, you realize that that's an illusion. And that came to be something that really informed a lot of my work over the years.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the points that you make is that for a lot of people, the time that they really start thinking about the environment or really become active in environmental causes is when something's happening in their own backyard.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen, I'm 47 years old, and the environmental alarms have been ringing in the media since I was a baby, you know, and louder and louder. And we have this system where we have scientists who go out and find these problems for us, tell us about them in the media, and then we, you know, have environmental organizations we give money to, and legislation is passed or not passed. And, you know, certainly there's been some progress over the years, but I don't really think that's how we connect with these issues in a meaningful way that will really change society. I think it has to happen much more personally than that. You know, if it's an issue in the long list of issues that we deal with when we read the newspaper or listen to the news on the radio, well, you know, it's up there with a lot of competitors, you know, terrorism and the economy and so forth. But when it's an issue of how we feel about our lives, it's the places we live. You know, it's the places that we connect to personally and spiritually, and it's really much more important than just, you know, another political issue on a list of things that people are answering in polls.
Yeah. Well, there's a challenge to get people to think about issues when it's not in their backyard. And if you're here in Illinois, whether it's an oil spill in Alaska or one in the Gulf of Mexico, I'm sure there are a lot of people who think, well, that's a terrible thing, and it's a sad thing, particularly for the people who live there. But connecting to it, getting people to connect to it and think about whether or not the way they live their lives has any impact on that at all, that's really difficult.
Although, you know, after the Exxon Valdez, there were some very detailed surveys done that were paid for, you know, as part of the litigation. So they were done with extraordinary level of care and you know, over 1,000 people surveyed, you know, face-to-face, door-to-door. And they found out that something like 98% of the American public knew a significant amount about the Exxon Valdez oil spill, really cared about it, and were willing, when they're presented with the point of view, well, how much money would you pay to prevent this from happening again? They were prepared to put significant amounts of money on the line personally. And it was the sort of thing where they were told, well, we're considering a tax. So they were given to believe that it was a real decision that was actually going to cost them money. I think that people do care, and I think it's part of I think all of us have a sense of connection to the wilderness, even if we're not in the wilderness. We need to know that there are still wild animals out there, and that there's still nature that could, you know, goes its own way without, you know, human control. But then beyond that, even from a practical point of view, you know, our actions do affect all of these places, especially when you get into issues like climate change, where you know, even though, you know, certainly Illinois is affected as the climate warms and as you know, the habitat zones of animals and plants move to the north, and everyone on Earth is affecting that, whether we like it or not. So there is a you know, no longer are we in a position where we can kind of point to somebody else as being responsible for these things.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Charles Wolforth. He is a lifelong Alaska resident. He's author of the book The Whale and the Supercomputer. That book won the LA Times Book Prize. He's also written other books and articles about nature, history, politics, and travel in the North. He was the lead reporter for the coverage of the Exxon Valdez oil spill of the Anchorage Daily News. He worked many months in the field covering that story. He is now the author of a newly published book, The Fate of Nature. The subtitle is Rediscovering Our Ability to Rescue the Earth. And it is published by St. Martin's Press. Book is out now. Questions welcome, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. He's talking with us from Alaska. You're in a place where you like to spend your summer, is that it?
Yeah, that's right. I'm on the south side of Ketchumak Bay and can look out the window and see. I don't see them right at the moment, but we usually have a sea otter floating by right in front of our place here, and we have whales that swim by. And yeah, this is where I try to do as much of my writing as possible and spend time with my family.
Yeah. How can you still see impact now? As I said, it's been 21 years since the spill. Can you still go out the places where the oil washed up and see the effect of that today?
If you know where to look for it, you can dig down into gravel beaches and find fresh oil that still smells, you know, as strong as if you know, smelled it at a gas station. That's obviously not, you know, the spill as a whole hit something like 1,000 or 1,500 miles of beach, and there's only a few areas where you can still do that. But there's no question that there's still oil in those beaches, and it has a continuing ecological effect because the oil contains chemicals which tend to affect the reproduction and growth of various species and that are passed up the food chain from, you know, clams and mussels into birds and fish and marine mammals. And that has caused areas that were especially hard hit by the spill not to return to their normal abundance level of those species. And then the other really big effect is there was a huge herring run in Prince William Sound prior to the oil spill, which was a pretty important fishery and also a very important food source for a lot of different animals in the food chain. And after the spill, the herring started coming back for spawning with lesions and deformities, and then 4 years after the spill, they just stopped coming back at all, and the run crashed, and it's never recovered. So that, you know, major portion of the ecosystem simply isn't there. And questions is, you know, well, why after all this time would it not have come back are still a matter of study, and really no one's able to answer that question.
And are people still studying the environmental impact of the spill?
Yeah, they sure are. After the oil spill, there was a $1 billion legal settlement with Exxon. Half of the money was spent to buy timber rights and to protect land for future generations, and that was a huge, huge action. It protected an enormous amount of land, similar in size to, you know, a national park. And then the other half was spent on studies, and so about $500 million has been spent on studying the oil spill, and there's still money being spent trying to figure out some of these lingering questions.
We have a caller here. Why don't we get them in Plano, line number 4. Hello.
Hey, good morning. How are you guys today?
Good.
So I got a friend of mine who lives up there in Alaska in Anchorage, and he actually works for BP Amoco, unfortunately. You know, the funny part about it is we're all hypocrites, though. I think Americans in general, unless it, and like David brought it up, unless it happens in their backyard, we don't really care. And which is sad, because I used to work for the Forest Service years ago, and people, some of the abuse that I saw on a daily basis was just insane. But yet they don't want to give the money for, you know, that entity of the government to clean things up. It's I mean, part of the problem is, it's like, you know, we want it, but we don't want to pay for it. And I think in general, the way Americans are living is, I want the big cars. Even if you buy a Toyota, a Prius, a Honda or something or whatever, you're still buying gas to run this vehicle. We still have to have oil to lubricate the engines. And that's my big thing. I've got a diagram. My brother happens to work for an oil company also. And it, most of two-thirds of that, whatever comes out of a 55 or a 40-gallon barrel oil, goes into other products, and you use a third for gasoline. And people don't understand that. A lot of it has to do with chemicals, as far as, like, even in drugs. Some of the chemicals they use to spray fertilizers and whatnot. There's a lot of stuff. And as we're willing to give up some of the stuff, you know, we're going to lose a lot before we realize how far we've gone. I don't know. What's your comments with this? I mean, do you see the – I personally think that we're not educated enough anymore. I think we don't care. We're living in our own little realm, and if it doesn't affect us, it's not gonna matter. What do you think?
Well, I think that's true to a point. I mean, I think that it's pretty darn hard to even live in this society and not use fossil fuels. You really have to make that almost your whole point of your existence, because, you know, if you have a job in most places, you need to get there using fossil fuels. You know, if you have a home in a cold climate, you need to heat your home with fossil fuels to the most extent. And so I think, you know, people do have a responsibility to minimize their use. And then you sort of think, well, what else can you do? That doesn't seem like enough. But I think that changing the attitude is something else you can also do. So you can, as an individual, you can influence others, and you can start to develop the sense of responsibility that you're talking about. And, you know, as I look at these huge environmental issues that seem like they're bigger than any government can deal with, and the governments seem like they're frozen and paralyzed and unable to reach any kind of agreement on them. If the ordinary people start to change the way they look at the world and get beyond what you're talking about in the sense of it's somebody else's problem and really not caring about it, then the governments are going to follow, because they have to do what the basic tenets of society are. I remember actually talking to the former CEO of BP about this, and he was making a big deal about how they were trying to reduce their carbon emissions, and they did make a lot of progress from their company's point of view. And I said, well, why would you be doing this? This is not something for the bottom line. And what he said was he didn't want to be like the cigarette companies. You know, he felt it was very dangerous for a corporation to get out of sync with society and have society start to think and demonize a corporation. Well, it's too bad he didn't put a little bit more of that thought into his safety, you know, record. But I think that what the basic idea of what he said was right, is that we do control the norms of behavior in the society, and if we're going to take action on our own, and we're going to talk about that, and we're going to really express that, then that is a way that we can start to affect the whole thing.
Well, I want to thank the caller and invite some other folks. If you have questions, comments, you can email will-talk@illinois.edu, or you can call us at 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL or 9455. Either way, you'll get here to the show. My feeling is that that it's not exactly that people don't care. I think if you go out and you ask people this and sort of a straightforward question, do you care about the quality of the environment? I think probably most people will say yes, and that they will mean that. The difficulty, I think, though, is in if you then ask the question, well, what are you doing about it, or what do you think you could do about it? I think a lot of people aren't quite sure. or at least the list of things that they'll give you is probably kind of limited. I wonder whether, in fact, that does have something to do with education. That is, that they simply don't, they really don't have any ideas on what sort of steps, past the sort of basic ones, they could possibly take.
No, I think that's true. I think there's another thing that happens, which is the way our emotions play with us on this. And if you look at the climate change issue, it's a good example. You know, it went from the public reaction and what a lot of commentators said went from, well, I don't believe it's happening, directly to despair. Oh, it's happening, and there's nothing we can do about it because it's too huge and it's hopeless. And that kind of plays into the hands of those who want to keep polluting, you know. And I think that happens to us in our daily lives, where we think either what I do doesn't matter because the environment's not a real problem, or what I do doesn't matter because the problem of the environment is so big that my contribution doesn't make any difference. And if that emotion is spread over the entire populace, then you can be assured that we won't make any change and nothing will improve. But what we found on the climate change issue is that the only place that we've really made significant progress is on individual, community, state, and local efforts. And that at the local level and the personal level, people are making a difference. In my own situation, before I started writing these books, I didn't realize how much energy my family was wasting. And through just very simple things to do, which are very cost-effective, we saved probably 40% of the energy we use in our home and our transportation. And, you know, there's some areas you can't reduce, like air travel. You know, you could travel less by air, and we do that a little bit. But in terms of heating our home and lighting our home and getting around town, 40% was not that hard. And you can't tell me that 40% is insignificant. And, you know, if everybody decides to make those changes, they can do it. And then that's just, you know, way more than certainly our government is doing. So the attitude of helplessness or despair is misplaced, and it really just plays into the hands of those who would sort of like continue business as usual.
I have some other callers here. I want to get right to these folks, but just to talk a little bit about the place that you live, because the book really, it takes a look at your home state, talks a little bit about the indigenous people who live there and the experiences that they had and the place had when the Europeans came. And then there's a lot about the oil spill, Exxon Valdez. You say that there may be no better place to see the highs and the lows of our treatment of the natural world than Alaska, your home state. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, it's very, very true, because, first of all, it's just this incredibly beautiful, spectacular stage for this drama to be played out in, you know, where we still see these, you know, extraordinary, magnificent animals, you know, and we still have bears that come snooping around our place and, you know, whales that swim by and all this, these amazing things, and that when you look back in history, you find out that a lot of this wildlife was much more abundant 100 years ago or 200 years ago. And what happened really was the collision of two different worldviews. The people who lived here had a worldview in which they were part of nature, and they viewed their community as owning nature collectively and sharing the animals and sharing their place here. And the first Europeans to come were not really Europeans, but Russians, Asians, from the Russian Far East. And they had an ideology of, you know, grab what you can as fast as you can, and really made war on the place and committed acts of genocide against the native people. And then in 1867, Russia sold Alaska to the United States, and a different set of frontiers came this time from the east rather than from the west. But with the same ideology, and started destroying salmon runs and very severe environmental impacts from their point of view. And in each case, it was a matter of what was the worldview of the people that were coming, and how did they view their relationship to the environment. And now I think we're in a place where we have to decide if we are going to continue that frontier tradition, you know, of the Russians and of the U.S. Gold rush and salmon rush that happened in the 19th and early 20th century, or if we're going to kind of go back to an older way of looking at the environment and how we relate to it, which is what I hope we're able to do.
Yeah. Let's talk with some other callers here. Marshall, Illinois, next, line 4.
Thank you.
Yes.
I was wondering if you could check out a rumor, or what might be a rumor or exaggeration that I heard recently, and that was that there was an extraordinarily high morbidity and mortality rate among the workers who helped clean up the Valdez spill. And if they are still studying the environmental impact, surely they're keeping those statistics. And I'll hang up and listen to your response. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
Well, I don't know about an increased level of death. Not long after the oil spill in Alaska, I started to hear from workers who were complaining of a broad range of health problems that they related to working in the oil. And when I was out there, I saw people who were, you know, spraying oily rocks with high-pressure hot water and turning that oil into an aerosol and were then breathing it. And Exxon, you know, didn't want the imagery of people wearing protective gear, so they didn't give these people any kind of protective gear other than rain suits. And they would come back from working with you know, their sinuses full of black oil, and I couldn't believe that could not affect their health. But unfortunately, there was never any scientific follow-up as to what the health effects were, and these people, you know, tried to get together a class action lawsuit, and they really didn't get any backup from government investigators or regulators, and the issue was really allowed to just sort of die out. Well, you know, one problem was that when you have these big health issues, you know, like Agent Orange or like, you know, Gulf War Syndrome, it's really hard to pin down cause and effect and which problems are actually related to the cause you're looking at and which aren't. And when you had, you know, we had more than 10,000 workers out there, but they were all sort of laborers who went on about their lives, so that it wasn't exactly like a group that was easy to follow. So unfortunately, that was an opportunity that was missed, and there was no follow-up done, and those people never received any aid or support. And but now people from Alaska have gone down to the Gulf and have been lobbying and advocating for the workers there to be treated better. And from what I see, sort of looking at the media, it looks like they are getting more protective gear than the folks did up here. And in fact, one of the major complaints, it sounds like, is wearing the protective gear in the heat, which really makes it hard to do the work. And but I think it's really important that they do. One thing that has struck me as interesting as well is that the disposal of the oily waste here, it was required to be disposed of at hazardous waste sites. And from what I've read down in the Gulf, they're just putting it in the town dump. And I'm not sure how they're managing that, because I know when I change the oil in my car, you can't just throw it in the dump. It has to be put into a recycling system. And so, you know, the thing is, these are rare events, and they're obviously not easily handled. And it does seem like major issues, like this health issue, fall through the cracks.
Yeah. Something else that I think I'd like to have you talk about is, and this, again, goes to the experience of the cleanup and people deciding what they can and can't do. You seem to make this argument that maybe sometimes the cleanup efforts that we see make us feel good, because we see people cleaning otters and birds and things like that. But there are some questions about whether, as far as the environment goes, whether in fact that's really helpful.
Yeah, you know, there was quite a bit of work that was done in the Exxon Valdez cleanup that was more harmful than beneficial. And some of it was this hot water washing that I just mentioned, where the hot water would basically kill everything it hit. You know, you're in an environment where the water is normally like 40 or 50 degrees, and you hit it with something that's scalding, it's obviously going to kill it. And then all that high-pressure water would move the oily sediments into new areas. And another area was the sea otter rescue, which was something that was you know, highly photogenic and highly covered by the media, and everybody, you know, felt good that at least we're doing something for these poor animals. But it turned out that the rescue was, you know, torment for the animals, to be put into these dog kennels and to be, you know, cared for. A large percentage of them died while they were being treated. And then after they were released, virtually all of them died in the wild that they couldn't make it after they had been treated. And then there was the added concern that they could be taking, you know, domestic animals like dog diseases, distemper and so forth, out into the wild and killing many more otters. And there's some evidence that that may have even happened. So what happened, you know, we ended up spending $90,000 per otter to rescue these animals and did no benefit to the individual otters or to the population of otters. So they then start thinking, well, what did we spend the $90,000 for? You know, really it was just to make us feel better about this horrendous disaster that we caused through our actions. And to me, that's just one more assault on the environment that we're doing for what's really not a very good reason. Hmm.
Our guest, Charles Wolforth, he's lived all his life in Alaska and has written a number of books and articles about nature, history, politics, and travel in the North. He's author of the book, The Whale and the Supercomputer. That book won the L.A. Times Book Prize. His newest is The Fate of Nature, Rediscovering Our Ability to Rescue the Earth. St. Martin's Press is the publisher. The book is out there in the bookstore if you'd like to read it. Questions here are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. I want to express a sort of a contrarian point of view when it comes to particularly people, indigenous people, people who live in non-technological societies and their relationship with the environment. And I think that there are some people who would say, you know, we can actually go back and we could look at the ancient world, the pre-industrial world, and find examples of human-caused environmental disaster. Deforestation, probably one of the biggest ones. And I think that there would be some people would be prepared to make the argument that human beings, once they get the tools to do it and the numbers to do it, they're going to trash the environment. And that the reason that maybe in pre-industrial societies that didn't happen is that there weren't enough people and they didn't have the technology that was at that level, but that they always exploited and sometimes exhausted the environments, their environments, their local environments, to the extent that they had the ability to do that. And that people now are still doing what people have always done. It's just there are more of us, and the tools that we have to bring to bear on the environment are more sophisticated.
Well, I guess that is the basic question that I wanted to address in my book, which is that, you know, is it human nature to essentially overrun the habitat in which we've been given, which is the planet Earth? And if your point is a correct one, then there's really not much point in talking about all this because it's within our human nature to use more and more and more until it's gone. And so we're inevitably head towards either, you know, best case, a completely domesticated Earth where there's nothing wild left other than, you know, whatever humans decide to have for sort of our entertainment. And the Earth is kind of a giant farm. That would be best case, or worst case, we run out of resources and there's some kind of a cataclysm. And so what I wanted to address in my book is, you know, when I talk about the fate of nature, it's really what is the, if you think about Greek tragedy, you know, the outcome of the play is determined by the personality of the protagonist. Is that, you know, is it pride? Is it that will lead to the fall? Or in our case, is it, you know, greed and materialism? And I come to the conclusion, looking at it a little bit more fine-grained than you're suggesting, that there have been many societies on Earth that have shared common resources and have done so in a sustainable way. And certainly there have been others that have not. But the fact that we have at times successfully lived in harmony or at least within the limits of our ecosystem is proof that it's possible. And there's actually a whole academic movement looking at this, led by a professor named Eleanor Ostrom, who won the Nobel Prize for Economics last year and became the first woman to do so. And she's done the theoretical groundwork of showing, you know, in the lab that these cooperative impulses in people are very real, and that people do prefer to cooperate and act in a socially positive way and to assist each other and to share resources when it's possible. And then also she's gathered thousands and thousands of case studies from all over the world of cultures other than our own that live within an ecosystem where they have to share resources or destroy them, and that this concept of the tragedy of the commons, where everybody just goes for the most until it's all gone, is only one possible outcome, that there are other outcomes that are much more positive. And I think I found an example of that in writing about the Chukch Native people here on the coast of Alaska, but there are certainly many others. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, one of the excuses we give ourselves for our society is, well, that's just the way people are, and we're taught that, and that serves a certain point of view of people who do want to just get as much wealth and develop materially as fast as they can and beat everybody else. But that's not that's simply not the truth. That's just simply there are other potentialities within people, and we need to be told that. We need to accept that.
Let's talk with someone else, and this is someone in Champaign. Line one, hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Good morning. Well, I was listening on and off, and I hope I'm not repeat any of the topics, but one of the callers have said about the that people sometimes, if it's not happening with us in our backyard, they do not care too much, and I think that the big corporations, the international corporations, are having a free green light from our politicians. They lobby them, and they can get away of cutting expenses, bringing down any regulations, and they know that. It's happened every time when there is a disaster. Any of those big corporations have been the big donors for this administration, Obama administration, previous administrations, and yes, it's not some of the people are aware of what is going on. Most of the people don't care because it's happened in Florida, Louisiana, Katrina, Vietnam, Korea, Afghanistan, Iraq. Who cares? We have an Oprah Monday Night Football and American Idol, and that's all right for us. So, and I do believe those corporations cannot do any of those if they do not bribe or lobby politicians, and they give them a green card for everything, free ride.
Hmm. Well, what do you think, Mr. Wolfert?
Well, I mean, I think in essence what he's saying is correct, is that we really have, it's not a new phenomenon, you know, it's one that has been in existence for a long time. When you have a large hierarchical government system, that those who have, you know, money and power are able to influence the government to their benefit, and I suppose it shouldn't really come as a surprise. It's as simple as the human nature that the congressmen, you know, who do they talk to all day? You know, lobbyists, other congressmen, people, you know, wealthy, influential people, and they come to take that worldview and take their information from those folks. And in fact, there have been some interesting studies done where you approach government leaders with contrary information based on, you know, scientifically done surveys that show that people feel differently than they think. And they'll actually discount those surveys and say, well, that's not what my gut tells me. And this is an issue that goes back to the founding of our government, you know, that the idea of how far away can an elected official be from the people who are electing him before he stops really representing their point of view. And I think that in a country of 300 million that's represented by, you know, the 565 in Congress, we've definitely gone beyond that point. So when you get into really technical issues like oil spills, it's quite easy for the oil industry to capture the people who are supposed to be regulating them and to really be able to do whatever they want. And that's what happened with the Exxon Valdez, where very serious shortcuts were made in terms of safety, and it seems to be, again, what happened in the Gulf of Mexico. And in that way, these are very closely related oil spills, that the cause is easy to defined. It's the government capture by corporations of the government regulatory system, and then the subsequent lack of diligence in taking care of safety. And there is a solution, which is to bring the power back down to the people who are actually affected. The local people who pay the price for the accidents. And that's something that we've been able to institute in Alaska, at least with the shipping of oil out of Prince William Sound. Unfortunately, it didn't spread anywhere beyond this, and I'm hopeful that as we look towards the future, that will be something that increases. I don't expect people in Illinois to be thinking day-to-day about how blowout preventers work in the Gulf of Mexico or how oil is shipped out of Prince William Sound, but I think people in Prince William Sound could be expected to keep an eye on that, and I think people in the Gulf of Mexico could, and they probably would because they have a lot at stake. And if they were given the power, I think that they would make sure it was done a lot better.
I want to thank the caller. We have about 6-7 minutes, and I have some other folks here I want to get to. But just to go a little bit further with that, what is it that the people there in Alaska, particularly around the area where the spill was, managed to do in terms of coming together and working for their own interests there? And is there something there that can be that people other places can learn?
Yeah, without a doubt. What happened was that during the hysteria after the oil spill, when the Congress was willing to do anything, they got a law passed to create a citizens council, which is based in Prince William Sound, and it's funded by a mandatory tax of millions of dollars on the oil industry. And so how it works is the council has got fishermen and naturalists and just regular local people on it, and then they have the money to hire engineers and technical experts and PR experts and to have access to the oil facilities. And so they're constantly inspecting and checking on the activity there and then making recommendations. And if their recommendations aren't followed, they have the PR wherewithal to go to the media and create a faucet so that they do get attention. And even though they don't have any regulatory power, just that setup where they have the money to do the oversight has had a tremendous impact. And I think our oil shipping in Prince William Sound is probably the safest anywhere. The follow-up question, why aren't we doing that other places? And I think we should be, and hopefully we will. But it's kind of the syndrome where there's an accident in Prince William Sound, so you fix the system at Prince William Sound rather than fixing it everywhere.
Let's take another call in Chicago, line number 4.
Yeah, the environmental impact is increasing day by day. It's from the news that's being reported about the danger of the gusher. They don't even call it a spill anymore because it's gone through such huge dimensions. And besides the environmental impact, the impact on the population who may, as I hear, potentially may have to evacuate. And we're talking about a population of almost 20 million people in the areas that may be involved. So in China, I understand they can build a city every month, but I wonder how our country can deal with an exodus of a population of dimensions we hadn't even contemplated. I know in China, when they've had a dam constructed, they've had to displace 1 million people here and there, or earthquake occurs, and people are living in tents and so on. And so the ramifications and untold consequences are yet to be encountered, and how we'll deal with it is who knows. I thought I'd mention that, and thank you very much.
All right. You can
right.
Comment on that any way you like.
Well, I couldn't hear everything he said, but I think that the question about people having to evacuate or move away from the Gulf Coast is probably not going to be caused by the oil, although if the economic dislocation is enough, if there's enough loss of jobs, people would have to leave. But the underlying question about the displacement of people due to these environmental changes we're facing is a real one. As you look at climate change and the rising of the oceans and coastal areas becoming flooded, there's a high probability that there'll be mass dislocations of people. It'd be relatively easy in the U.S. because we're rich, but if you think about places like Bangladesh and other low-lying nations around the world where people are very poor, I think you can anticipate that there will be, you know, major refugee problems in the future. It won't happen all in a certainly gradual way. It'll happen through storms and through natural disasters, which will become more frequent.
We're coming down to the point we have maybe about 3 minutes or so left, and we always come and we have these conversations. I think we always come to this point where we're talking about, well, to where are we headed? And as you have said, you actually find reason to be hopeful. And it's easy, as you've also said, when you have these conversations to think, kind of sort of to throw up your hands and say, well, these problems are just too huge, they're just too big, they're more than I can deal with, they're more than everybody can deal with. You're really, what you're trying to do is have leave people with a much more positive kind of thought about the potential for people working together to solve these problems.
Yeah, and it's not that I am saying in the fate of nature that we will solve these problems. I think we're in a great drama as we see sort of what is the outcome for the Earth and how we live on it. But what I'm saying is we do have the potential or the capacity to solve these problems. We're not built as being machines that will necessarily destroy the place where we live. And I found it a little bit discouraging that just the fact that I say, well, it is not inevitable, it makes me viewed as being highly optimistic. People seem to have fallen that far into despair about the environment that they have accepted that it's hopeless. And I really think hope is our only and our very best tool for making change. You know, if people have hope and they start to see the great impact they can have through their personal actions and their community actions, then that is how we're going to start making change. And so hope and the desire to take our fate into our own hands is critical, and that's if there's any one message I want to leave with people, that's it. You know, that don't give up. You can have a big impact, and your community can have a big impact, and you, as a part of that community, are the most important things of all.
And this is, I think, there's a real important distinction to be made here, because I think that there are some people who do say that, well, they think that we can deal with the challenge of human impact on the environment, but they kind of say it this way. They think, well, technology will help us solve problems that technology has created. And it seems to me that you're coming at it from a very different direction. You're saying, no, it's not our technology that's going to save us. It's if we can get in touch with our true nature as human beings, that's the thing that's going to save us.
Yeah, and that's a really perceptive point that you know, technology, we've sort of been on that path for quite a while, and if you think about how much energy a home uses now compared to what it did 50 years ago, well, it uses it far more efficiently thanks to technology. But because of the way we live in bigger homes, we're actually using more energy per person. So technology is not getting us there. Instead, we have to think about, well, why do we want to live in that huge house in the first place? You know, we might be more comfortable and happier in a smaller house. And that, in fact, what gives us happiness as human beings usually is not just greater material wealth and working harder and earning more money. It gives us, you know, getting up to a level of sufficiency where we have what we need to get by comfortably. It certainly gives us more happiness, but after that point, usually it makes us more stressed out and less happy, and we get to spend less time doing the things we really enjoy. You know, so part of this is just figuring out, how do we want to live? You know, do we want to work and commute all the time, or would we rather enjoy our lives, spend more time with our family, and do some of these other activities that are actually much less costly to the biosphere?
Yeah, it just seems, although I hear what you're saying, I still think, in as much as we continue to talk about how it is we for so long have measured our well-being in material terms, and people say, well, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense, that those aren't the things that are really important. We're talking about this. It seems, though, that going from talking about it to making a really big change in how we think about it, that's still difficult.
Yeah, I think it's a lot of people a little bit at a time. And one way I think about it is if you think about these huge cars like a Hummer, is that seen as a status symbol, or is it in some sense seen as something shameful to be, you know, that wasteful of resources? Well, in different parts of society, it's seen as a huge status symbol, and in others, it's seen as something that you wouldn't want to be caught dead in. And so those are the kinds of social norms that are going to influence us in how we use the environment. And what I've seen is that as people start to take these actions, as they start to do things for their own communities, you know, pick up trash or do it, whatever volunteer action it is, they become more and more those who see it as a moral and ethical and a social need to be positive in these ways.
Yeah.
And I really think that that's happening. I mean, if you don't hear too much about it in the you know, mainstream media, but if you get down to the community level, you see a lot of that stuff happening.
All right, there we'll have to leave it. You want to read more, look for the book we've talked about, The Fate of Nature, by our guest Charles Wolfert. He's a lifelong Alaska resident, also author of the book The Whale and the Supercomputer. Mr. Wolfert, thanks very much.
It's been my pleasure, and I welcome more questions from readers. My website is fateofnature.com, and on Facebook you can just search Fate of Nature, and answer any questions I receive.
All right, great. Thanks.